You know, a leader without followers is just somebody out taking a walk. Leaders grasp movements, aspirations, desires of many people. They don't necessarily dictate what people think. They embody the aspirations of ordinary people. What I want my readers to understand, what I want Americans to understand about the revolution is its real richness. Hi, this is Jack Warren. I'm the author of Freedom, The Enduring Importance of the American Revolution. A new general history of the central event in all American history, the American Revolution, which established our independence, created our republic, defined our national identity, and dedicated the country to ideals of liberty, equality, natural and civil rights, and responsible citizenship. And those ideas have defined our history and will, I think, define our future.
This is the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore. Jack Warren Jr. is author, as he said, of Freedom, The Enduring Importance of the American Revolution. Freedom's a look into British America, the Revolutionary War, the birth of a new nation, what freedom means, how the events of the past hold importance even today. Jack Warren is a native of Washington, D.C., whose work focuses on the American Revolution. He attended the University of Mississippi and Brown University. He and his wife, Janet, have three grown children. He considers himself a historian of American public life. What do you mean by that?
Well, historians, a couple of generations ago, most of them were political historians. They talked about when they talked about public life, about things that happen and that affect us all. They dealt with presidents and elections and Congress's laws. I think public life is bigger than just politics. I think it involves all of us. And one of the themes of this book is the role that ordinary people play, the enormous role, defining role, I believe, that ordinary people played in shaping the American Revolution and thus the American Republic.
Can you expand on that? What did ordinary people do? I mean, when we hear about the Revolution, we hear about Washington and John Adams and Jefferson and Benedict Arnold and Horatio Gates. But what about the average citizen?
That's one of the flaws of the way we talk about our revolution. We talk about a group we call the Founding Fathers, a phrase I don't use anywhere in the book except for in the appendix where I discuss why I don't use it. The Revolution reflected the aspirations and the ambitions of thousands and thousands of ordinary Americans. They differed from the aspirations of George Washington or Thomas Jefferson. And we can only understand the Revolution if we understand the aspirations of Americans broadly. At the end of the day, we talk about the Revolution frequently. You'll see discussions of the Revolution I think degenerate into debates about what Alexander Hamilton or James Madison thought the Constitution meant, and we tend to focus very narrowly on these leaders. But you know, a leader without followers is just somebody out taking a walk. Leaders grasp movements, aspirations, desires of many people, and they don't necessarily dictate what people think. They embody the aspirations of ordinary people to some degree. They have their own. And what I want my readers to understand, what I want Americans to understand about the revolution is its real richness, its complexity. Ordinary people had all kinds of different aspirations. Some cared deeply about the threat posed by British taxation, but mm-hmm. Say the Townshend duties, which taxed paint, paper, lead, tea, and glass. Well, many people in the American colonies didn't use those goods, most of which were actually luxuries in the 18th century. But they cared deeply, say, about their opportunity to cross the Appalachian Mountains and settle in the fertile river valleys beyond. And so when the British imposed the so-called Proclamation Line of 1763, forbidding settlement beyond the Appalachian Mountains, lots of ordinary people were upset by that. They looked forward to the opportunity to live better lives and to to move west. And so the understanding the revolution, this is just one example, is we have to understand the aspirations of ordinary people to improve their lives and the threat that they saw in an increasingly assertive imperial regime that the British were erecting in the 1760s and early 1770s.
You said that John Adams said the revolution actually took place before the fighting. Was he right?
That's a complicated question. Adams, of course, was a statesman, and he was. Well, I think what he was talking about when he says the revolution occurred in the hearts and minds of Americans before fighting began is that without a commitment to a set of ideals, the revolution, the war itself, could not have taken off. And so what happened between, say, 1763 and 1775 is vitally important. It's a really major part of the American Revolution. Candidly, I wince when people refer to this book as a history of the Revolutionary War, because Adams was right in the sense that the Revolutionary War was just one part of a broader movement, the American Revolution. But Adams, I think, didn't quite appreciate the degree to which the Revolutionary War changed America. It changed the sentiments of people. He spent a great deal of the American Revolutionary War abroad as a diplomat, and so wasn't on the ground to see it happen. The Revolutionary War was an enormous event. I mean, it was spread across the entirety of what became the United States, from Florida to Maine and westward to the Mississippi River. It touched almost every community, thousands upon thousands of families, and it lasted a long time. I mean, that's a really simple thing. It lasted 8 years, the longest war in American history up until these undeclared wars of our generation. And it transformed the economy. It transformed the relationships between people. It forced the government to come up with strategies to employ the resources of the country in the cause of war. And so the war was a wrenching and transforming event, chaotic and tragic in many ways. But the idea that the revolution occurred before the war began is an interesting talking point, but I think it discounts the importance of the war in transforming the country.
You do say that the revolution was not a minor war. I mean, some of us think that. I mean, We're sort of look at the image of somebody with a fife and drum and a couple of muskets going off to fight for a little while. But as you point out, it was a long war.
A point I made earlier, it touched every place, from the Florida frontier, which was in the southern limit, to all the way to Maine and westward to the Mississippi. So unlike, say, our Civil War, which affected mainly the Deep South, and of course the war touched only the southern states except for the brief forays of Lee and Bragg northward. So it touched every place. An enormous percentage of the American people were at some time or another caught up in the war, touched by the war. The war came through their town. The war looks small, your immediate point. The war looks small to us because this was a very, the population was modest. The country was geographically much smaller than it has become. And so it does look small to us. But in fact, a higher percentage of Americans were casualties in our Revolutionary War than in any war in American history, except for our Civil War, and in the Civil War, both sides count, of course, North and South. The battle casualties of the Revolutionary War were small relative to later wars, certainly the Second World War, the First World War, or even our Civil War. In fact, all of the battlefield casualties of the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, the Mexican War, and all of the Indian Wars, conflicts that had taken place between the Revolution and the Civil War, were exceeded by the casualties at the Battle of Shiloh, the first really titanic battle of the Civil War in 1860. More people were killed and wounded at Shiloh than had been killed or wounded in every American battle since the beginning of the Revolutionary War. And so it's easy for us to look back and say, well, wow, the Revolutionary War was modest in size. But as I say, as a percentage of the population, it touched more people, it involved more Americans than any other conflict in our history. And the people in the 19th century who looked back to the Revolution recognized that. Lincoln spoke about it once. He said that, you know, you'll see it in every family. You know, there's someone who's been wounded or crippled, some story in every family of someone who died in the Revolution. The story of the Revolution, he said, was sort of written in the face of ordinary Americans. And, of course, Lincoln was a boy when veterans of the Revolutionary War were mature men.
What is freedom?
It's a complicated idea and very important, because what I want people to focus on here in this book is the achievements of the Revolution, because we have a tendency in recent years to disparage our Revolution, or many people, without getting their hands around what did the Revolution achieve. And my argument is that the Revolution built the foundations of freedom. Well, what is that? We use that term, throw it around rather loosely. We treat liberty, for example, as a synonym for freedom. Freedom is a complex of different ideas, some of which, candidly, are in conflict or can be in conflict with one another. Liberty is one of them, the absence of restraint. That's what liberty is. When I teach about the American Revolution, when I've taught about the American Revolution, one of the things I'll ask the class immediately is, what is liberty? Liberty is the absence of restraint, right? So our Bill of Rights, one of the climactic achievements of the American Revolution, is mostly about liberty. And it's about what government will not do, right? You think of all of the amendments that begin with that phrase, Congress shall make no law. Liberty is the absence of restraint. In a way, liberty, mirror image of civic responsibility, that is civic responsibility or responsible citizenship is a phrase I use, is the recognition of obligations that we have to one another, to the body politic, to public life, and that we have to, for a republic, another idea that is embedded in freedom, to be effective, people have to be willing to sacrifice their private interests, at least some of the time, to the public good. And so freedom consists of liberty. It includes civic responsibility or responsible citizenship. It also includes ideas which are at the center of our legal and constitutional life, natural and civil rights. And those terms get used a great deal in modern discourse and misused. People talking about their rights, and they do it in a very fuzzy sort of way, which is not good for their preservation. There are natural rights. And the 18th century, you know, was fascinated by these, and philosophers and practical politicians talked a great deal about natural rights as a component of freedom. Natural rights are rights that inhere in all people, in all times, in all places. They are not connected to any political form, no constitutional regime, and they're not bound by time or place. And those, we sometimes refer to those as human rights today. But that's a modern phrase. But the natural rights and human rights are essentially the same idea. Mm-hmm. You know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, the Declaration says, that all men are created equal, they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that is, rights that cannot be taken away, not justly in any case, right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, Jefferson is talking there, and Congress is articulating an idea of natural rights. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we have civil rights. And civil rights are vastly important, but civil rights vary from society to society, to government to government. Civil rights are the rights we enjoy in civil society that make public life work. The right to vote, for example, is not a natural right in the sense that it inheres in all people in all places. It varies from polity to polity and should. Based on different social and cultural conditions, what the expectations are. Civil rights and natural rights can sometimes be in conflict with one another, and a great deal of our highest constitutional adjudication actually deals with the issues about the conflicts between our ideas of natural right and our ideas of civil right. For example, our continuous discussion in modern times about gun rights, the Second Amendment to our Constitution at its heart, is really about the distinction between natural rights and civil rights. Is the right to own a firearm a natural right, or is it a civil right? That is it conditioned by circumstance, a civil right, and therefore malleable? Or is it a natural right, an immutable one, an inalienable one, in the language of our Declaration of Independence, an absolute, and therefore cannot be tread upon by government?
So which do you think it
that
is?
That at the heart is what the debate is about. Freedom.
Which
is
do you think it is? Which do you
which
think
do
it
I
is?
Do I think it is?
Yes.
Well, now you're asking me a modern political question, which is fine. But the historian job is not to. My job is to lead the horse to water, to share the past with people, to ask people to have a broad and deep understanding and appreciation of the past, and then to use that learning, that knowledge, to inform how they think about public life. And so, yes, my experience working on the American Revolution gives me a sense about what about the right to bear arms as a component of freedom. And I recognize the tension. I'm not smarter than the great mass of Americans. The Declaration insists, for example, in asserting our natural rights, that we have a right to life. Well, the right to life certainly would include the right to defend your life. It would be meaningless otherwise. And so the right to bear arms of some kind, to hold arms, to use own arms, seems to be implicit in that. But then the civil libertarian has to ask, is there any limit to that right? Is it an absolute right? And of course, it isn't an absolute right. We all acknowledge that, except for maybe a tiny number of people on the fringe of one side of this debate. We would all agree that you and I don't have a right to own a nuclear weapon. That is the most powerful arm we can imagine. That there are arms that it is not good for civil society, for individuals to control, and that they need to be controlled by the state, by the people collectively. So we've already agreed on that, right? The question is where the line is drawn. I think that the right to bear arms, while it's grounded in our natural right to life, has to be defined as a civil right. And we do that. All of our gun laws, all of them, whether they be mild or very strict, are ultimately laws that relate to a civil right. We regulate things that are essential to regulate, to maintain civil society. But we're uneasy about this one, and we naturally are, because the right to defend yourself, the right to defend your life, is an immutable natural right.
Freedom's a wonderful idea, but at some point during the interview, I wanted to dredge up a quote, which is not really a quote because it's not word for word, but at some point, the British Tory, I guess you'd say lover of royalty, Dr. Samuel Johnson, said in terms of America, you hear the loudest yelps for liberty from the drivers of Negroes. We had there were people enslaved at the time of the Revolution and after the new republic was formed. Women couldn't vote. Doesn't seem to me that they didn't have the freedom that others did.
That's absolutely true. Let me back up a second and make sure that none of our listeners think that Dr. Johnson, Samuel Johnson, is a touchstone for freedom, and that all of the things he said were deep and wise. Johnson was horrified by American resistance to British authority and advocated the most strenuous, aggressive, and violent measures to impose British authority, monarchical authority, on the American colonies. He was not a friend to freedom in that sense, and said lots of intemperate things about America. Now, he was right in this one instance. He asked this rhetorical question, why do we hear the loudest yelps for freedom from the drivers of slaves? Well, there's an answer to that question. Americans saw in their daily lives people who were deprived of freedom, all freedom, who enjoyed no liberty whatsoever. And of course, you know, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, they were all involved in enslavement. In fact, the entire Atlantic world, including Dr. Johnson in his comfortable London home, they were all caught up in enslavement. Enslavement was a global tragedy. Every place that had been colonized by Europeans, from the tip of Argentina to the north to Canada, at the beginning of the American Revolution, slavery was practiced, was legal, was accepted, and there was virtually no opposition to it, except for among the people who were themselves enslaved. Never say that there was no anti-slavery movement when, in fact, you know, slaves resisted and resented slavery from the beginning. But among whites, anti-slavery sentiment barely existed before the American Revolution, just a few on religious grounds. Pennsylvania Quakers, for example, were generally opposed to slavery, but not even among them universally so. The Revolution, the American Revolution, by articulating ideas of universal natural right, began the process by which global injustice was dismantled. It's one of the absurdities of our time that Americans have been misled into thinking that somehow the American Revolution was about defending slavery. The American Revolution was about spreading freedom.
During the summer of 2020, you sat beside a statue of George Washington to talk to protesters. That sounds like a brave thing to do. That was a brave thing to do. Can you talk about that a little bit?
It wasn't as brave as all that, but at the time, I was the executive director of the American Revolution Institute of the Society of Cincinnati, which has its headquarters on Massachusetts Avenue in Washington, D.C. And we were, I don't know, 10 or 12 blocks from the heart of the protests in the summer of 2020. And we had placed on the lawn in front of our building right on Massachusetts Avenue a statue of George Washington, a copy of the famous Udall statue of George Washington. But like what Houdin wanted, the artist wanted, we placed the statue at ground level so that you could walk right up to it and look Washington in the eye. Well, if you were over 6 feet tall anyway. Anyway, it was vulnerable in that sense. But it was also a great public attraction. People would come up and have their picture, you know, made, pose with Washington. And like so many of the statues in Washington, which are in the city, which are up on, you know, giant pedestals, this one was approachable, and we wanted it to be so. The artist wanted it to be so. They wanted you to think, he wanted you to think, and we want you to think about Washington's basic humanity, about his ideas and his struggles and his conflicts. And looking at him face to face helps with that. And naturally, you know, in that difficult summer, lots and lots of icons of our history were attacked and threatened, vandalized, destroyed, by people who were angry, but who did not understand that the freedom that they think all people should enjoy is founded in the American Revolution. A movement for freedom has to begin somewhere. And Washington and the leaders of the Revolution, though they lived in a flawed and imperfect time by far, as do we, began this movement. And it was a movement, the Revolution, that began in the dark, in the darkness of a time of tyranny and oppression, in which the rights of women, of African Americans, of indeed of people of African descent everywhere, it seems, were ignored, where natural rights was a philosophical abstraction that didn't inform public life anywhere, really. And the revolution was fought to establish the foundations of free society at a time of great darkness. It had to begin somewhere, and it inevitably began with people who were flawed and imperfect and who were participants in the very injustices that they fought against and in which their ideas ultimately changed. And that's what I told people who approached the statue. I just sat outside and said, well, why did, they said, people would come up and say, why did we put up this statue? Why did we care about George Washington? I would explain, Washington made the free society that we live in and its future possible.
Jack Warren is author of Freedom, The Enduring Importance of the American Revolution.
Each and every week, part of the Historians Podcast. Now above 500 podcasts recorded over the last 10 years. We have this little feature at the close of the podcasts called History Mystery. Bob Cudmore puts all of this stuff together.
Yay!
There you go. All right. So we're to the point, it's not going to take much this week to give you the question, following question. Where was George Washington born? It seems to me you heard this information in either third or fourth grade. You probably don't remember. Where was George Washington born? Four choices. Raleigh, North Carolina. Pope's Creek, Virginia. London, England. Or Lexington, Massachusetts. The answer in about 60 seconds.
Thank you, Dave. We've just done episode 500 of the Historians Podcast. It has arrived. It's quite a milestone. We hope you can make a contribution to honor that achievement. You could donate whatever you want, from $5 to $25 to $50 to $500, any amount. Make your donations online, first by staying on our website, if you're on our website, and clicking the blue button to the GoFundMe campaign, where you can give using your credit card. Or you can do it the old-fashioned way, much like George Washington probably would have done. Make out a check to Bob Cudmore and then mail it to Bob Cudmore at 125 Horstman Drive, Scotia, New York, 12302. And do listen to our episode 500 if you get a chance. We have it archived on our website. The featured guest, a man named Dana Cudmore, who is no relation, but that's another story. Thanks to all of you who've already given to the History Project. We need to raise an additional $2,000 by the end of the year, and time is running out. Please make a contribution today. Our question on the history mystery, where was George Washington born? Was it Raleigh, North Carolina, Pope's Creek, Virginia, London, England, or Lexington, Massachusetts? Well, the father of our country was born in Pope's Creek, Virginia. Pope's Creek, Virginia. Now, thanks to our guest, Jack Warren Jr., author of the book Freedom, The Enduring Importance of the American Revolution. The Historians Podcast is produced by Dave Green. This is Bob Cudmore.